General Sir David Thorne, Reel 2. Saying that you understood the more sophisticated aspects of trench digging later on when you were commanding platoon, does this mean that you were digging relatively crude or simple trenches? What, do you remember what sort of trenches they were when you were in the potential leaders?
I think the aim was more to teach us the general principle that when you come to a halt, or when you wish to defend an area, you need to get under the ground, or a large part of your body protected by the ground. But some of the more sophisticated aspects of trench digging, extending on to when I was a team commander of the nuclear problem and so on and so forth, none of that was part of our, what it was, I suppose it was 8 to 10 weeks we had of potential leaders.
Up to what level did you do the tactics? Did you stay at section level or did you go up to platoon
section
level?
Section level.
So it was the section attack with the Bren group and the rifle group.
Yes, it was very basic fire movement. It was teaching us to shoot effectively, both on the range formally, and a small amount of sort of live firing in terms of fire movement.
Field firing. Where was that done? Was that done at Thetford or somewhere?
That was at Thetford on the battle area, very brief.
When you did these section attacks, did you have opposition from within the platoon or from other units? Were they opposed exercises?
I can't really recall there being too much of a formal enemy. I think it was to make a general point and also to encourage us to start to understand that leadership begins at section level. I think more of that.
Was there an emphasis on one aspect or another of this training? Because you mentioned the outline of a normal syllabus with things like field craft, weapon training, map reading, drill. Presumably also you did a certain amount of signalling besides the field signs. And do you recollect thinking that one thing was given rather more favour than the other?
I think one of the features of the soft regiment in particular, and to a less extent the 9th of Foot, but particularly the soft regiment, who provided quite a lot of the training cadre for this this training organisation, was they were always a very good shooting regiment. Oh. Right. And I would say what they did best was, I think, their training in shooting and skill at arms and weapon handling generally. And other than that, I think they would probably not have been an exceptional organisation. There was good training in the Middle Square, there was pretty good minor tactics training. But what I remember perhaps most, other than the entertaining moments, which always one of the stigmas of mind, was the shooting. And maybe it's because I enjoyed it. Because it takes you a little time to understand whether you enjoy shooting. As you know, I mean, if you get, first of all, you get a bloody great, we never had any earplugs or anything like that, it always came up the range of the year, didn't we? But there's an enormous satisfaction of developing from being rather frightened of the rifle to being confident in it, and the brand, and suddenly realising that you could be very good as a shot. And that's it gives them an enormous personal satisfaction. So in a sense, perhaps I'm just remembering what I enjoyed most.
Did all the people on the Potential Leaders course carry on, do you know? Or were there those who dropped out?
Some of them certainly didn't, and I can't remember who went where. Several of them got to Sandhurst, but quite a few dropped out. Because it was quite intense. And in a sense, you knew at the end of the day, if you kept going and you got through, you were at least going to be up the ranks in terms of corporal and sergeant. But more likely, you were going to end up in some form, either at Sandhurst or at Eaton Hall or wherever it might be. And curiously enough, one of the things that happened was that I went to I just left for Sandhurst, and my twin brother arrived, and he came into the audio room, and the company commander then, who was a chap called Palmer, heard this voice, and he bellowed out, "Thorne, what are you doing back here?" Well, of course, it was twin brother Mike, whose voice is exactly like mine, and of course, we look exactly alike, and, you know, it was sort of a bit of a standing joke from then on, but, the company commander had been unable to tell the difference between us.
It can have its uses, can't it?
It can indeed, yep.
Was there a lot of emphasis upon the physical side of training and the potential leaders?
Yes, you basically were being taught how to get yourself fit and the importance of being fit. So physical tests were a constant process, both in the gym and in terms of runs and in terms of marches, and marches to a certain speed and so on and so forth. So respect for physical toughness started very early on.
What sort of length of route march would you do?
Well, from memory, up to 10 miles, and then I think we had a set piece distance we had to do at within a certain time. I think it was a march, which I think I'm talking about 3 or 4 miles as the sort of one where you had a test and you had to pass a certain level.
A combat fitness test.
That's right, the equivalent of that. Although what they called it then, I'm not quite sure. I can't recall.
Did you have to do a march and shoot? Was there a...
Not that I recall. I think on the whole they were kept separate. And of course there was fitness in terms of runs and there was fitness in terms of marching.
Games, was that emphasised?
We had quite a lot of sport. It was a summer. And because I was a good cricketer, basically, I was easily hauled off by the depot to play all over the place, inevitably. Because, you know, I'd already played cricket for at least once or twice for Norfolk then. And so, you know, that was a nice interlude.
How were you assessed? Was it done by any formal tests, or was it done by the opinion of the instructors who were looking after you?
There were certain tests, obviously, like shooting, like the fitness, like the drill, because as I recall, we passed off the square. And the rest was, how did you get on with your fellows? Did you work as a team well? Which is much more observation.
That's subjective rather than objective, isn't it?
That's right. You subjective can... judgments were being taken all the time.
Because you can count the shots on the target, but...
Yes, but it's how you interrelate with the rest of your section within the platoon is another thing.
Was that more important? Did they regard the human side of it as more important than this measurable material achievement with the weapon, shall we say?
Equally. They expected you to get to be up to scratch on the measurable, and they expected you to fit in and be very happy to be part and enthusiastic about being part of a team. And I think Sergeant Charlesworth was very shrewd, and he knew a lot about us. He was very proud of it, you can tell, and he was a damn good leader.
Was he a long service regular?
Yes, he was in Northampton.
Northampton.
Yes, he was. He was long service. But I would think his age was 30, 32. He'd seen service. He was fit. He was a really good example of what a sergeant should be for us.
Had he seen service during the Second World War, do you think?
I don't think he'd seen too much service during World War II. Perhaps a year or two, and that was it.
Did he actually draw on his own background of experience to instruct you?
I just know that we respected him. And there were others there, Corporal Pond, who'd had too much of it all, but whom we also respected for what he'd done and his military medal. But we saw straight through the rather sort of juvenile, not actually doing his duty and being seen to be clever with his men. Mm. Right? So we saw through that. but we just lived with it because he was the corporal. And, you know, so we just stayed mum and played the game with everybody, so to speak.
What did you have to do to actually get into Sandhurst rather than going to Mons or Eaton Hall?
The reason I went to Sandhurst was because I was going to be a regular soldier, just like my brother, when he joined, was going to do national service and then take up his degree study at Oxford, Worcester College. My brother actually got the stick at Eaton Hall, which was far more than I did to Sandhurst, so to speak. Well, I didn't do badly. I got into sort of the top 10 or 12. But,
so this was this determined when you went to the recruiting office that you decided you wanted to be?
It was determined by the family, basically, that I should go into wrong operation as a long-term career. My father was dead by then, and so, what am I saying? No, he wasn't. But he was abroad in Africa, and so really, we were taking a lot of these decisions ourselves, I think, about that. Just entirely practical. Because one of the other key things is that to go to Oxford you needed money in those days, and we couldn't afford to send two members of the family to Oxford. We couldn't afford it. So there's a logic, practical logic to it, and then I was very happy to go into Oxford.
So you did your 2 or 3 weeks of training, basic recruit training, then you were in the potential leader's platoon, did you say for 3 months or so?
I would think it was 8-9 weeks. Mm. About 3 months in all. It was probably 10 weeks, actually. Mm. I think I ended up at Sandhurst at about late September, early October.
You went straight from the potential leaders onto him?
Straight in.
What happened to you when you got there?
Sandhurst. Then one started marching even faster around the square. Mm-hmm. I was in Eep Company.
Eep Company.
Eep Company, and we had the first young Gurkha there, Aditya Rana. He was one of us. Sergeant Goman, the coach, and he's a Coldstream Guards, was our sergeant major. And Sergeant Bowditch, our sergeant. His names are coming back rather easily. This is very suspicious.
They tend to be remembered.
Yes, absolutely, for what they were, which is actually magnificent people.
Where were you living?
At the huts at the back, behind Old College. And we worked flat out. And we, once again, were taught about discipline, and you know, you went on parade, and you knew, however good you were, you had a try like stink, but the odds are you were going to be charged. If you buy earth, then dust together. In other words, it was to get you used to accepting discipline, and we used to get up behind the company line, and we'd try on, we'd say it didn't have a bus pass to go and this, that, and the other, occasionally. But Aditya Rana in Nepal, sort of the alternative royal family in Nepal, the Ranas, Aditya used to show us all up. Because he used to stand and take his medicine. He would say, yes, sir, and no excuse, and go off and try even harder. And we Brits would at least try to argue the case in front of the company commander. And in a sense, Aditya taught us a lesson, which is really that, you know, there's some things that you just accept and get on with it. And it took us a little longer than him to pick it up. And I think it's all credit to him.
What would happen to you if you were done having a dirty beret?
You'd have extra duties, or whatever it might be. Basically, you would have some sort of extra punishment, which would usually be to do some extra cleaning, some extra...
Extra drills,
oh yes, practice that all day long. And we did become very smart, and I can remember the company commander, Dicey Grattan, who was in Royal Hampshire. And again, it's a very small world, because my father was seconded from the Tanganyika police at the beginning of World War II to set up with others the Somali Gendarmerie in Somaliland. And towards the end of the war, and he did a good job, but towards the end of the war, there were very serious riots in Mogadishu. And my father was involved and centrally involved in sorting out these riots, in which some people were shot. So he was court-martialed. And the court-martial went to, he was convicted, and he appealed. He appealed through the War Office. And who was the officer in charge of the appeal? What? Major Grattan, War Hampshire Regiment. So when I turned up, and my father was, I frankly think quite rightly, he was, his appeal was upheld by the Queen. Because it was basically a political, very strongly political exercise to blame somebody, because to me, sometimes you need to blame somebody to get the political scene right again. Anyhow, Dicey knew my father's case. And here was one of his sons appearing in his company. And if I could sort of take that a step further forward into the present. I thought Dicey Grattan, by the way, was the finest old-style sort of field officer of the pre-war condition. A really far-seeing gentleman. A very good man to... You felt very comfortable with him, you know. Anyhow, just to carry that story forward, my father, when he came back to the police in Tanganyika, as I've only recently discovered, obviously, I think, had been seen by the people in East Africa as having done a good and very difficult job in Mogadishu. So when there were riots in Zanzibar, who did they send for to sort out the riots in 1952? But my father, with 35 special constables, which again he did. And they then kept him on there, and he became the assistant commissioner. And he died in post. Right. And I have, I'm in the process of sorting out his grave out there, because it's formed to pieces. And his personal servant is still alive in Zanzibar, Gerald Thomas, who's taught us a lot about my brother and I about a father, because we didn't know, because basically he died in harness while we were, had just become soldiers in the 9th of Foot. And so once again, it's a curious world that sort of, you know, we're now caught up with my father through his private servant, who explains to us some things which we now understand, which is about his proper relationship with the people in East Africa, who understood what his value was, which is basically that he could take difficult decisions. And you take difficult decisions, sometimes the thing falls against you, sometimes it falls for you. But they have to be taken. That's a great digression, but it's... We were with Dicey Grattan.
You were with Dicey Grattan. You were in the huts behind Old College.
Sergeant Bowditch.
Sergeant Bowditch. And Sergeant Major Gorman. You were in Eat Company. Yeah. How long did the Sandhurst course last at that time?
I think it was a year and a half. And my one of my first abiding memories of that was that they gave us motorbikes to learn how to drive, ride motorbikes. These were great, big, heavy things. 500cc, I can't remember. They were big bikes. And so we had our drill. We had our weapon training. We had our academic instruction.
What did that consist of? What were you learning?
History. History of warfare, a language. I was learning Spanish. Why? Because I knew my French was so bad, I better start on a new language, so I did that. Some calculus and maths, or particularly maths, military writing.
That was, presumably that was a military subject rather than an academic one, law. Service writing.
Yeah, so in the classroom on the military side, in the classroom on the academic side, out in the field, there was tactical training up to platoon level, there was shooting again, there were confidence courses, there was fitness training, we were often in the gym. It was a good course, and it was thorough, and a lot of sport. A lot of team building.
You're mentioning that when you first arrived, it was really back to the start with the inculcation of discipline on the square and so on. Was that consistent all the way through the 18 months, or did you find that it eased off a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. It was graduated so that your first term, you were the bottom. And you just ran and ran and you strove. And you were disciplined, and you occasionally got a quirky smile from the company commander, or one or two little bits of encouragement. It was gently done, but broadly you were under the hammer to see if you could take discipline and could absorb it and could respond to it. The second term, doing 6 month terms, was just trying you out to see, just sort out who were the leaders and who were the, within the officers, you know, who were going to get well on. And then your third term, and here you began to see more and more Mr. J.C. Lord, who was a tiring figure and inspiring figure. And by the end of the second 6 months, they decided who were going to be the junior under officers and the senior under officers in each company. And you're beginning to see who was going to end up well up the order of merit.
What about people being back squatted or falling out altogether? Did that happen in the first term or in the subsequent term?
Very much in the first 6 months. And there was a sort of a place where people would be eased up a bit if they thought they got the potential further up the hill, so to speak. Not many got back squatted. Some did.
Did you have many people being back squatted for medical reasons? As opposed to...
I don't think so. It was... there must have been some, because we sure didn't hold back. but I can't recall that. I think most of us made it. I think it was slightly, because it was 18 months, and 6 months the tranches, it depends how you put the pressure on people. And if the pressure is quite intense and it's sustained, and people are fearful of failing, they sometimes will overstretch themselves. And that's how they get the physical injuries to their knees, to their joints, and whatever it may be. We certainly drove ourselves very hard. We got pretty damn fit. I think back squatting was not a thing we noticed a lot of.
You mentioning tactical training. Was that done mainly in the field or in the classroom?
That was a small amount in the classroom, mainly in the field, and round the local sort of heath land and the woods and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, we sort of rode off most of the motorbikes on our training, without a doubt, and it became so expensive that they stopped us doing it in our particular term, and we were knocking them off like flies, frankly.
How long would your field exercises last? Would you go away?
Oh, 2 days.
2 days.
And then I think we went off once or twice for a bit longer. But we knew that straight after this we were going to go to high and warming stuff and to do much longer training. And I can't recall us doing... I can recall us being out for one or two nights, but not much longer. I can't recall us going away for any major exercise. So maybe we didn't. Or maybe my memory's gone.
And you said here that you were doing mainly platoon tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the basic level. Did you study company or battalion?
We were army group level at times.
Army group level?
And then we were really looking at the broad strategy as well. So not too much company tactics in the classroom, much more platoon tactics on the ground, a bit of company tactics, just explain how companies fitted in. And so we would look at history and at the strategy of armies. And that, I think, was quite a... I mean, I love history, so not a view of that. I enjoyed that very much. But to what extent it really... how important it was, I'm not quite sure.
Did you get use of sand table or cloth model as part
yes.
of the...
Yes, I can well recall that. There was some good training like that in the various halls. I can't remember the name of the halls, but they were at the back.
Woolwich Hall, perhaps?
Yes, I think that makes sense.
And the old college model room?
Old college model room is what I remember. And... yes... There was some good stuff there. But the training was more about the corporate teamwork of tactics, less about initiative. And looking back, I would say we were living still in World War II. We were living still in the world of a large army, which tended to be more monolithic, like the Russian and the American armies.
A conscript army.
Yes, a conscript army, where the tenets of leadership are very much there, but the need to maximise upon all your talents was not the first thought. At all. It was to get people to do one or two simple things really well, let the initiative be at a higher level.
This sounds as though it is derived from the tradition of continental warfare rather than the British tradition of colonial soldiering.
Yes, I think so. I think the effect of World War II is still there with us.
Do you recollect any studies of counterinsurgency or internal security and colonial campaigning?
I don't recall it, which tells me that if we did, it didn't stick. Basically, we just wanted to pass and pass well and have a damn good game of rugby or cricket as often as possible. I played squash for the academy, and played cricket for the academy. Broadly, I had a very companionable and enjoyable time.
I was going to ask you about the social side of life while at Sandhurst in those days. What sort of things went on?
What sort of things went on? Yes, indeed. And one of the things I have to say about... Oops. Sorry. I mean, I think it depends upon your talents. A lot of people would go tearing up to London. But my interest, and I come back to the first time I went to the training depot, I'd go out alone quite often on my own. I find when I'm taking on something new, even now, when I've just taken on a major task, which is affects the government and the Prince's Trust and other organisations. Always in the first month of most of these things, I stand back from people and I really concentrate on finding out what I've got to do and defining it clearly. This is why, both at the depot and at Sandhurst to begin with, I took stock. There's an element of me that took stock very carefully and made sure that I was going to achieve what I needed to do. And so the first little while in both those places, I could have been seen as a bit of a loner. But of course, the thing that really tends to draw me always to people is that I'm a good sportsman and so on. I make strong friendships, but I don't.